This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Snoozers, literally, at Campbell Pavilion. A dispute over families, housing, and zoning in Hartford goes national. And what is actually happening at the state capitol to try to solve this state of permanent fiscal crisis? Anyway, you can join our conversation in the wheelhouse as we talk about the news of the week. 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org. Or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Joining us here in co-misery with me, suffering from probably the same ailment as Mark Pazdiokas, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Hi there, Paz.
Good morning, John.
And Christine Stewart is here. She's editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Christine, welcome back to the show, and welcome back. It's the first time we've had you back since you've become a new mom.
Yes, yes.
So tell us, young Caitlin is just 6 weeks old?
6 weeks old.
My goodness.
Yes. So she's sleeping pretty well, but, you know, can't complain too much.
And how does this sort of interfere or work with the life of a hardworking, entrepreneurial news reporter who's covering every single thing that's happening at the state capitol? How's that going so far?
She's not contributing yet to the website, so the internship program has a little ways to go.
Internship program is like, but congratulations to
you.
Doug. It's so good to see you once again and have you back in the fold here. Now, there's a lot of news this week to cover, but we're going to start with the news from just yesterday. Former Republican candidate for Connecticut's 5th Congressional District seat, Lisa Wilson Foley, was sentenced to 5 months in prison. She was convicted for her scheme with former Governor John Rowland, who himself was sentenced to about 2.5 years in prison just last week. Lisa Wilson Foley spoke at the sentencing, and she apologized. Her defense argued she was a minor character in the scandal. It was a claim the judge didn't buy. I'll get your take on this first, Colin. Anything that really surprised you out of what happened with Lisa Wilson Foley here?
Well, rarely has somebody's plea for mercy so persuaded me of the necessity of incarcerating them. I actually really did think she gave a poor account of herself. I mean, I guess maybe the phrase that jumped out at me or the claim that jumped out at me is she said, "Nothing prepared me for the ugliness of politics." As though this were politics's fault somehow. In fact, I mean, this was a very ugly campaign by Connecticut standards from the get-go, before we even knew of John Rowland's involvement. Lisa Wilson Foley and her compatriots were running a very ugly campaign. So, I mean, it's simply not the case that she was this innocent walking into the hellish, you know, underworld of politics and being confronted by all the evil therein. She had four primary opponents in the Republican primary, none of whom were doing the things that she was doing. She also said yesterday, well, she was a little naive, you know, in running for Congress, maybe she just should have run for town council. Well, it's a little late to have that apersu. I mean, it seems like, you know, she was actually running against Mike Clark, who had been on the Farmington Town Council. So that thought might have jumped into her mind from that location, if from nowhere else. And I guess I do think it's, you know, I'll make one more point and then
sure.
I'll pass the baton. One thing I have noticed is in these last two sentencing hearings, both the judge and the prosecutors have, I wouldn't say gone out of their way, but they haven't failed anyway to mention their annoyance at WTIC, at the way in which the campaign used John Rowland's position on WTIC to attack Andrew Rohrbach, and just sort of the way there was this very porous membrane between what went out over the air on WTIC and what was going on in the campaign. And I don't know whether they're trying to create a record because, in fact, I hate to sound like a disgruntled former employee, but because there's been some challenges to the FCC license of WTIC, or whether they're just sending a message to TIC and maybe everybody else, dot your I's, cross your T's, we're watching you now.
Mm. And for our younger listeners who don't understand what Colin's talking about, WTIC, it's an AM radio station. You may not be familiar with this. You can Google it. You can look it up online. Paz, what was your takeaway from the sentencing?
That was so petty and bitchy on so many levels. I love it.
I've got a cold, man. What can I say?
I'm with you, bro. I'm with you. Yeah, her comment about the ugliness of politics was, I think we can safely say, disingenuous on many levels. We have a photo on our page today that was taken at a candidate's debate in 2012, where she's seated near Mike Clark. And Mike Clark, of course, to remind your listeners, was the FBI agent who investigated John Rowland. After he retired, he went into politics. So, you know, it's another reminder that Connecticut is a cozy little state. But in this photograph, you'll see this odd look on Mike Clark's face. And Lisa Wilson-Foley is seated. You know, it's a whole array of candidates. And four of the five candidates factored in this trial, either as witnesses or, of course, in her case, defendant. And Mike Clark was the complainant who got this all going. But Clark has this really befuddled look on his face. And he told me eventually what had happened right before I took that photo. And that was Lisa Wilson-Foley went up to him, got in his face and said, "How dare you suggest I did anything wrong?" And this was just as this was becoming public, that Roland's involvement with her campaign. So even that, then, I mean, when it was all about to come crashing down, she was, you know, she basically, you know, verbally assaulted Mike Clark before this forum. So, you know, it's like the judge didn't buy it, the prosecution didn't buy it, and I would modestly suggest that the public don't buy it either.
Over the course of the last year or so, Christine, we've been talking a lot about what was going to happen to these key characters in this case, and you said to watch what happens with Lisa Wilson-Foley. Is what happened what you thought was going to happen?
Yeah, you know, the prosecutors asked for, you know, a 10-month sentence, and she got 5 months, which is pretty steep sentence for somebody who had pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge. So it's, the government, the federal government is keeping an eye on these candidates and is not going to put up with any corruption in Connecticut. And I think that they're always watching and people need to be aware of that. What's interesting about this is through her attorneys yesterday, she requested to be sent to a West Virginia prison where Martha Stewart served her 5 months.
That did stick out. So she actually wanted to go to the Martha Stewart jail?
She did. She wanted to go to the Martha Stewart jail.
And do we know whether or not that she's going to get that?
No. I mean, that was her request. And I just think it's odd that Martha Stewart had actually requested to be in Danbury, because we have a women's prison here in Danbury. So it would be closer to home for Lisa Wilson-Foley. So it's unclear why she chose West Virginia.
Because Stewart did do the decorations while she was there.
I see. Yeah. Yes.
They call it Camp Cupcake.
Well, okay. So I suppose moving on. So we will see, and we'll wait with bated breath to see whether Lisa Wilson-Foley ends up at Danbury, not too terribly far from home, or at this very nice place in West Virginia, which I'm hearing so much about these days. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Colin, it's sort of because we're talking about this Roland scandal, and we've talked an awful lot about John Roland and all the things that have come out of this, and you wrote a couple of really big, I thought very thoughtful pieces, one for Salon and one for the Hartford Current about this. You're probably just sick and tired of talking about John Roland, so let's actually move the ball forward a little bit and see something you and I've talked about a little bit in the newsroom and that you wanted to talk about today is whether or not we're starting to see a Rolandization of politics at the state level with this administration in a completely different way. We're not talking about some of the same stuff, but just maybe some of the same tripwires or some of the same things that are happening in state government that we might want to watch for as we've seen in the past.
Right. I mean, look, Dan Malloy has a long, long way to go before he's on the same, in the same ring of hell as John Roland. But, from the very beginning, even from the outset, 4 years ago, one of his first acts in office was to begin kind of weakening some of these watchdog agencies, or at least placing them under an umbrella agency that sits within his own administration. So, and those watchdog agencies were agencies that either played a key role in or were strengthened because of the Roland debacle. In recent months, we've seen some real questions about how the Democratic State Central Committee, which has a very porous membrane with the governor's office, handled contractor donations, whether those donations somehow or other inappropriately made their way into a state campaign through the federal accounts, complicated. But this week we saw some questions raised about whether some of the post-Roland contracting reforms were going to be subverted by the Department of Transportation. And I think maybe sort of a couple of last things. One thing to watch is, going back and looking at one of the things that happened in with John Roland, one of the things that he did was to pack a lot of agencies with people who were politically connected to him. They weren't fabulously qualified for their jobs quite frequently. And an interesting example, the guy who was the corrections commissioner back then, John Armstrong, was a guy who had actually been in the a warden or maybe in a deputy commissioner or something in the system before. Roland fired all the commissioners, then all the people that he had there, and then couldn't really get the guy he wanted or the person he wanted, and so reappointed Armstrong. And a lot of people, I think Mike Lawler, the most persistent critic of Roland's corrections system, would tell you that Armstrong wasn't too bad a commissioner, but he was surrounded with Roland cronies, with guys who could pick up the phone and get John Roland, and John Roland could pick up the phone and get them. And so a lot of things happened that the commissioner didn't even necessarily want to happen. So that's something I'm going to watch in the next 3 years. You know, are you starting to load up the state departments with people who are politically connected to you, who you can get on the phone for a conversation about something that they wouldn't necessarily want to do if they were just sort of operating their department any way they wanted to? And I mean, you know, I don't mean to paint Dan Malloy with the same brush as John Roland, but you know, people stay in office for a while and it changes them.
Well, okay, so one way to look at that, Paz, is something I'm told often by people who seek and then get higher office is, well, who should we hire? Who should be running these things, if not people that we know, if not people who we feel like can get things done? I mean, what's your take on Collins' take?
I think that's – at this point, I think that's a stretch, making that – even that distant connection to what happened to John Roland, particularly in his third term. And there seems to be something really god-awful that happens to many people in a third term. If there is a cautionary tale, and this is don't run a third time. I think there's a lot to watch in Malloy's second term, but it's a question of, I think, ambition. He came in with the idea of he was going to remake state government in many ways. And I think the economy and the fiscal crisis has forced him to really trim his sails. And the question is, can he somehow transcend that? Right now, I don't see him doing so. You know, the question is he going to sort of settle into just sort of trying to get by for the next 4 years and playing a little bit on the national stage, not because he sees himself going anywhere in national politics, but because it's interesting. I mean, this is a guy who loves challenges. This is a guy who wants to be intellectually stimulated. I mean, these are in many circumstances, these are all good things. So I think to me that's the thing to watch in Malloy's second term is the degree of engagement in Connecticut state government. You know, he said something about, you know, he raised the question of do we have a sustainable state government given the revenue versus the burdens of government. And but he really didn't follow up with that, and he's shown no interest so far in drilling down, to use one of the governor's favorite terms. Okay, what does that mean? I mean, because if you really think that government is not sustainable as it's currently structured, that's one hell of an undertaking. And so far, we don't see Dan Malloy digging that deeply and that kind of thing.
I feel like Governor Malloy at the moment is very disconnected. You know, he actually went on a vacation.
Which I liked to see. A lot of people complain about someone going on vacation. He went on vacation, I think, to Puerto Rico. That's a smart thing to do for anybody. Good for him.
No. Yeah. Everybody needs to get away.
Yes.
I completely agree. He has been kind of disconnected, though, in the budget process, handing the legislature a budget that's, you know, $54 million over the spending cap, saying he's not going to deal with it. You guys deal with it.
And the way he said that, too, and we were going to maybe bring this up later, Christine, but essentially what he did is he made these very strong statements about what needed to happen in a tough budget and then handed it over to the legislature and kind of washed his hands of it in a way that I didn't ever expect him to really do.
Yeah, so he did wash his hands of it. In addition, he hasn't, you know, he came out with this big transportation initiative. We're going to look at improving infrastructure over 30 years. And he was supposed to appoint some sort of panel to make recommendations. He hasn't even done that yet. He's in Washington, D.C. These past few days. You know, I don't know what's going to happen next year when he becomes chairman of the Democratic Governors Association. I don't know even how much time he's going to be spending in Connecticut.
Because that's going to be a big job. Pass.
Yeah, his approach on the budget is the contrast with 4 years ago is night and day. You know, at this point, 4 years ago, he had conducted 10 of his 17 town hall meetings where he went out and aggressively sold, you know, a tax increase that, you know, depending which math you use, it was either $1.5 billion or $1.8 billion. as well as selling the concessions that he was demanding from state employees. I asked him about that right before he left for Puerto Rico, and he looked really surprised when I said that people view this budget politically as more difficult because the options are fewer. And he said no. He said, well, maybe for the legislature, but not for me, which was stunning to hear. So his approach to this is completely different. His rationale was he felt he needed to close the deal on the concessions, so that required a campaign, and that he needed to build support for this gargantuan tax increase. So that was on him. This year it is, you know, he made it quite clear. It's in the legislature's hands right now. You know, I think he will reengage at some point. I mean, this is gonna stay ugly and indeterminate for several more weeks. But it's one party government. You know, when people say, "Well, we're going to be here all summer trying to figure it out," well, when it's one party government, there's no excuse for that. At some point, he's going to have to sit down with the legislative leadership and decide which way they're going to go on this.
I just want to say that the road to doing something wrong, to making a big mistake, like doing too big a favor for a contractor or a campaign contributor, is usually paved with these kind of little tiny concessions. Most politicians who make these kinds of mistakes, and I would even include John Rowland, don't think they're doing something wrong. And we've seen Malloy weaken the watchdog agencies. He then weakened the campaign finance laws. I mean, that bill came straight out of his office. We're now hearing that they may want to change the DOT contracting rules. So you start doing stuff like this, and then maybe the other thing that Malloy, I think, has lost is he had Roy Occogrosso in his office, and Roy is probably one of the guys who can tell Malloy he's wrong about something. I mean, and Roy may have a somewhat Sicilian approach to governing, but Roy could easily say to the governor or to anybody else, you can't do that. You can't do that. You're not going to do that. Forget about that. I'm not sure Dan Malloy has anybody in his circle anymore who can do that. And that's how you make mistakes. If you don't have that advocate for the other side or the person who's willing to stand up to you, that's how you make mistakes. And I do think he's a little bit at risk here. I mean, he hasn't done anything terrible now, but he's kind of set the stage for doing something terrible.
Just to get a little bit more detail on something Collins mentioned, I'll just read from our friend Neil Vigder's piece on this, the State Department of Transportation asking the legislature to remove several hurdles on the hiring of outside contractors and consultants to help it carry out the vast scope of projects envisioned in the governor's plan. Well, anything else we know about that, Christine, about this plan?
About the governor's plan?
About the governor's plan
to
change the contracting rules.
Yeah, we're not sure yet. I mean, things are in the legislative process, and they're changing, and they're getting legislative input. And, you know, I know that there's also some proposals to change how campaign finance works again, too. Which is concerning, and it's being pushed by the Malloy administration again. So,
and another thing that I think that we're going to be talking about on the show in the coming weeks, Paz, part of this plan too is this transportation plan that again was unveiled with quite some fanfare and now has kind of somewhat taken a back seat. Is an idea to create a kind of a quasi public agency to deal with the development of transit oriented development projects around rail stations. Now, this is something that has a lot of people from towns and cities who are on these rail corridors right now going, hold it, what's in that again? Are we talking about the state taking over vast swaths of land and redeveloping it?
And that also feeds into some of the concerns that Colin just articulated. You know, you see something, you know, you see these quasi-publics and there's the transparency is never quite there. On the other hand, the quasi-publics do sometimes provide other funding alternatives, you know, if they have the power to borrow, because that's the big unknown with the governors. And I won't call it a plan. I'll call it more a vision for transportation over the next 30 years. There's no inkling right now on how to pay for one bit of it.
Is the sense, and again, from where I sit, not being at the Capitol every day, there is a sense that as much as we do have to deal with budget problems, we do have to solve some of the things that the governor has put in the legislature's lap, we're kind of feeling like this talk of trying to build new casinos has actually taken over the brain space of a lot of people at the state the state legislature. Is that actually true, Christine? I mean, are they really talking so seriously about casinos and some sort of gambling revenue that that is eating up a lot of the oxygen in the room?
No, I think that's pretty much a distraction. I don't really hear them talking about, you know, the revenue that can be generated from the casinos. It was one of the, you know, proposals that was put out there. I actually this past weekend, I actually went and drove around and looked at any possible sites where they could put a casino, where you could put your, you know, slots in a box and you know, get off the ground quickly. But none of the revenue is ever going to be realized through 2017, even if they got it up and built.
And it's not additional revenue.
It's right.
I mean, this is a holding action.
Cannibalizing other gambling revenue.
This is trying to intercept as many people as they can on their way up 91 North to the Springfield Resort.
Yeah, and I guess I just bring this up, Colin, before we head to break. Once again, I think we mentioned this last week on the program, that it does seem remarkable that we're able to mobilize an awful lot of activity very, very quickly when it comes to the need to preserve jobs, because we're under attack from some sort of Minuteman militia in Massachusetts that has casinos on their mind. We can't really get other things done very quickly, but that's something that we can rally an awful lot of support around right away.
Yeah, and I said this last week, but I actually think the jobs part of this is a little bit of an illusion. I mean, I think this is really about stabilizing revenue for the casinos and stabilizing revenue for the state. I would just echo what everybody else said. It's probably not going to work anyway. I like the idea of brain space in the legislature, by the way. It's almost the definition of a seller's market. I mean, there's sort of not that much of it.
Colin McEnroe is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Christine Stewart is the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Mark Pagnaiokas is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. When we come back, we'll consider more of the week's news later on in the show. We're also going to be talking about UConn women's basketball. Not a whole lot of fannies in the seats at Gamble for some pretty big games. What's going on there? You can join the conversation, as always, here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today is Wednesday, our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. So we're tackling the week's news with Christine Stewart, the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, Mark Pagnaiokas, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, and also our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show each weekday at 1 p.m. What's on the show today, Colin?
It's horrible. We're doing a show about Rust, actually. I was blanking for a second. We're doing a show about Rust. Actually, this is going to be
It's horrible. I have no idea what the program is.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, you could sort of argue that America's yearly worst natural disaster is Rust. Rust kills people, and Rust costs about $500 billion a year to either fight or replace things. And the environmental consequences of Rust, when ships, old naval ships sitting out in harbors, just kind of collapse and release toxins, and it's just really bad. So Rust is terrible.
Rust never sleeps. That's this afternoon at 1 o'clock with the Colin McEnroe Show. Hope you can join us for that. One last thing just to follow up on our previous segment's conversation. Does any of what we talked about earlier, Colin, fit with the appointment this week by Governor Dana Malloy of longtime Cigna executive Catherine Wade as the new insurance commissioner? She's the daughter-in-law of a prominent attorney who's a self-described pal of Malloy's, someone who's been a big Democratic fundraiser. Does this sort of fit into the category of the things you were speaking of earlier, or not really to you?
I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer to that question. Let me just sort of – and I think Paz has written a little bit about the Jim Wade Dan Malloy relationship. He can probably put some details into that conversation. Let me just say this. And I'm actually very uncomfortable talking about this topic for a particular reason, which is so the scenario that has been put out is that Katie Wade, who's the daughter-in-law of Jim Wade, who's been a very, very influential Democratic figure dating back to, I believe he ran the 82 Bill O'Neill campaign.
Yes.
And the 86 Bill O'Neill campaign. He certainly played, when Bill O'Neill got into office as a full-fledged governor, he played a very similar role in terms of vetting appointments and stuff like that. He's been around that long. She's his daughter-in-law. She's the new insurance commissioner replacing the well-traveled Mr. Leonardi. His deputy commissioner, Ann Melissa Dowling, therefore did not become insurance commissioner. I know Ann Melissa Dowling pretty well, and I really like her a lot. And I think she's very smart and very capable. I think she would have been a very, very good insurance commissioner. And I really mean that. However, I do have to say that the way that this narrative has spilled out, it's kind of omitted the fact that when she was appointed deputy commissioner, she was the sister-in-law of Tom Ritter, who's about as powerful a guy in the state of Connecticut as there is. I would argue Tom over the last 20 years has been more powerful than any governor. So, I mean, it just like everybody's somebody's in law. Everybody has some kind of connection. You know, we certainly see this in the Hartford Department of Public Works this week as well. So, I mean, I do think that Ann Melissa Dowling would have been a great insurance commissioner, but I'm a little uncomfortable with the argument that Katie Wade represents kind of a politically connected choice that's kind of different from the typical choices that get made.
Well, I mean, Katie Wade comes from, what, 20 or 30 years in the insurance industry at a high level, involved in regulatory affairs. There's no question Jim Wade was an early supporter of Dan Malloy, was very helpful with sort of the – you know, kind of traditional Democrats to the extent they're still around. Katie Wade, I'm told, also was an early supporter of Malloy and has her own relationship with Malloy. So, yes, I mean, Dowling had a lot of support. There was some grumbling that she didn't get the job. I've had people describe that, you know, she lobbied pretty hard for it in different ways. Some industry people I've talked to, you know, you get some mixed readings on this. I mean, I don't sense any shock and outrage among the industry folks. You know, there people wish that Lenardi had spent a little bit more time, not just in Connecticut, but on national regulatory issues as opposed to international issues that he was very interested in. There's some minor grumbling that that Dowling's focus maybe was a little too broad a field too. But again, you try to figure out, you know, who's best for this job, good luck. You know, because obviously in the regulated industry, nobody's going to speak on the record about these two women.
Yeah. Christine?
No, that's true. And you know, Katie Wade's background, you know, she definitely has the experience and the resume is not unusual for the position of insurance commissioner. So it's, you know, it's difficult to say.
Paz, correct me if I'm wrong. I think this is also one of the commissionerships that is essentially funded out of fees from the industry,
yeah.
Right? Which
yeah,
always makes it kind of complicated too.
Insurance and banking are the, I believe, the two that are, you know, that are out. Although healthcare advocate, you know, there's a couple like that, yeah.
And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Very quickly, you mentioned a story that our own Jeff Cohen has been reporting on. So some of these ideas of political dynasties or whatever we want to call them come home to roost almost seemingly daily here in Connecticut. And it's happening once again in the city of Hartford. And it just draws me back to something you said earlier in the program, and I guess it's always a theme here in the wheelhouse, is you just can't go that far without running into somebody else that you know or who is related to someone. And it does start to make you wonder, not just couldn't other people get jobs in government, but maybe in a state so small, maybe we have to put up with a little bit of what looks an awful lot like nepotism. Maybe you could just talk us through the story, Colin.
Well, which story are we talking about?
Oh,
Hartford.
We were talking about Hartford and Sandra Key Borges.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, look, this is Mayberry RFD. I mean, we think we're some kind of cosmopolitan place, but we're not. And so, yeah, at the state level, you see this all the time. And, you know, most of the commissioners and deputy commissioners at the state level, you know, I mean, you know, there's the occasional Gina McCarthy who comes in with just these sterling credentials, but most of them come through some political pipeline. And I guess it's not that unusual that they're related to somebody. The audit of the department of Public Works, which already had a previous audit that had indicated that people were using drugs on the job and sleeping on the job and sleeping and using drugs at the same time while operating backhoes or whatever. I mean, it wasn't great. So now the latest thing is that there are people, a lot of people in the Department of Public Works who are family members of other very prominently and well-connected city officials. Occasionally, and I don't have the mastery of this story that Jeff Cohen has, but it seems as though sometimes they're also hired with very little documentation. So, you know, it's Hartford is illustrated, the city of Hartford has illustrated its commitment to traditional family structure, both in its opposition to the Scarborough 11 and in its fondness for hiring family members of other Hartford officials.
Yeah, and that's sort of our transition point to this next story. Of course, the Scarborough Street story, it's something that it was a little blip on our radar screen, something very interesting for people who live in Hartford. But as Colin and I often say, you know, if we tell all sorts of stories about things that are happening in intrigue in the West End of Hartford, an awful lot of the rest of the state probably turns off the radio very, very quickly. But it just turns out that this story of an 11-member family of sorts, people who've decided to live together and pool their resources to buy a big old mansion on one of the nicest streets in Hartford, this has gotten national attention. As a matter of fact, it got the attention of one Gail King, who hosts the CBS morning show, of course, a longtime Hartford newscaster. Here's her opining on this story after they ran a big feature on it.
I'm so sorry some cranky Yankee neighbor complained, because to me what should matter is, are you good citizens and good neighbors? You can have people that are related that are horrible, cause all sorts of problems, police are called. So here you have these people who are living very well, getting along, being kind to each other and good in the neighborhood. I think it's a shame.
And the question is, how do you address that under a zoning code?
I'm pulling for the family.
Oh, so there you go, Paz. It's sort of like with Cronkite in Vietnam. Once you lose Gail King, I mean, you've lost. I think Hartford has lost the battle over this issue.
I will confess, I have trouble taking aspects of this story seriously, because every time I see Scarborough 11, I expect to read that the Berrigan brothers have come back and are living there and plotting to overthrow.
Actually, this was actually a plot to overthrow Simon and Garfunkel. Yeah. That was Scarborough 11.
At the heart of the story, it's a pretty boring zoning thing. But the question is, it's like, it does reflect on the neighbors. It's like, come on, guys, is this really the biggest problem you have? Going back to our earlier, you know, kind of theme of how small the state is, I have to confess that, because I guess wasn't Kennelly one of the people complaining about this?
We're back to political dynasties.
Yeah, back to political dynasties. So this is John Kennelly, the son of Barbara Kennelly, who lives on the same street.
Directly across the street, I think.
And I have to, in the interest of full disclosure, I once owned the home that John Kennelly was raised in. This was not on Scarborough Street. Once upon a time, the Kennellys lived in a 1,500 square foot house in the south end of Hartford. But anyway, that's my connection to the Kennelly family directly.
Yeah, How many people were living in your 1,500 square foot?
Well, there were a lot of Kennellys at some point. Surprisingly enough, it was one full bath, and I'm not quite sure how they managed.
Yeah, well.
Well, I'm not too familiar with the story. I know that the lawsuit by the city of Hartford was just filed against the family last night for the zoning violation. Why do we have this law on the books in Hartford? Where did this come from?
Well, to fight against unregulated rooming houses popping up in your neighborhood. I mean, the underlying zoning rule, I mean, let's be serious for a moment. There is a legitimate public interest. This is about basically having rooming houses pop up wherever. That's where it comes from. This is a little different. Some of these people own the house. And they, by all accounts, they're a lovely group of people, very interesting group of people. But how do you make it fit into the modern zoning scheme? But that's where it comes from. The unrelated rule is to make sure you don't have, again, rooming houses just establish willy-nilly.
Maybe just to sort of quickly set the table for people who haven't followed this or who live in New Haven and wonder why we're talking about it. So what we've got here is, three married couples and their children and two individuals who are not couples with anybody. And what they did was they got together and they bought, a pretty nice house in the West End of Hartford, I think just a little bit south of $500,000 for the house. They pooled their resources. They live there together. And so they've fought a couple of different zoning battles. And on February 17th, they lost their fight before the Zoning Board of Appeals. And so what happened last night, as Christine said, is they were hit with a lawsuit saying basically you're not getting out fast enough, get out, or we'll start issuing civil fines and stuff like that. One thing that I would say is I think Paz is absolutely right. A city that doesn't enforce its zoning rules makes itself a very unappealing place to buy. And Gayle King, when she lived in Glastonbury, would not have been happy if the town of Glastonbury did not enforce the zoning rules and there was something going on in the house next to hers that she didn't like. So it's fine for her to sit there on the set of CBS Early Morning and say these things. But, I mean, nobody likes it if the zoning rules aren't enforced. That said, I do think that Hartford's approach to this has been very ham-fisted. There's been very little in the way of olive branches, very little in the way of even lip service from anybody except maybe Sarah Bronin, who's the chairman of the zoning board, or town planning and zoning or whatever they call it, saying, look, you know, these are creative, exciting people. We want them living in our city. You know, we'd love to reconcile this somehow, but we can't. We can't ignore legitimate I mean, you don't hear that a lot. And I can't help but wonder if that has something to do with the fact that it is an election year. There is a lot of money there in the West End and a lot of support for people's campaigns. I'm wondering whether Mayor Segarra or anybody else can really say that when the John Kennellys of the West End are up in arms about this thing.
And just again, to be clear, Mayor Pedro Segarra lives in his house just around the corner from there, not too terribly far from there. And Sarah Bronin, who Colin was just talking about, is married to a guy who's running against Pedro Segarra. And again, the very small circle paths closes quickly.
He's not that close. I mean, it's a couple blocks away.
It's a couple blocks away. It's all in the same neighborhood.
I just wonder if Bravo has pitched the reality series yet.
It's actually not such a bad idea.
It's a lot of potential here.
Except that they can't do it.
Yeah.
Well, they could pay the daily fine.
Right.
There you go. Okay. Well, Paz is now producing television shows. Mark Bazinokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Our own Colin McEnroe. When we come back, we're going to talk about why there are so many empty seats for the UConn women's basketball team on their home court in the NCAA tournament. What's up with that? Is it part of a trend that's happening in women's basketball, or is it just about ESPN putting on the game so darn late? You can join us here in the Wheelhouse right after this. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, and we're talking in the Wheelhouse today with Christine Stewart, the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, and our own Colin McEnroe. We've been talking a lot about state politics, a little bit about local politics and intrigue, but we want to turn to sports for a minute, and probably the most important sports team in our state. And it's not the men's basketball team at the University of Connecticut, which, of course, has had quite a bit of success over the course of the last few decades, but the women's basketball team, which has had more success than just about anybody. The problem is they make it to the NCAA tournament. They've got home games at Gamble Pavilion, and we're talking about 3,600 people, 3,400 people showing up in a stadium that seats about 10,000 people. We're not sure what's going on. We'll be checking in with Mike DeMauro in just a moment, but Howard from Manchester wants to chime in. Hey, Howard, what's on your mind?
Hi, thank you.
Yeah.
I've really loved the women's game, and been going for a number of years, and was to these two games. We're a little bit spoiled with the lack of competition. If you look at the Sweet 16 any year in the women's game, and you just select 1, 2, and 3, or 4, you'll have 13 or 14 teams every year. But obviously, the time was a factor with these games. But something that can be controlled. The games are more like rock concerts for the young people, and UConn women's fans are typically older. The noise level in the stadium is ridiculous. It's equivalent of a rock concert, and I go home with a headache each time.
Well, no, I appreciate your phone call, Howard, and thanks for chiming in. And this is really one of the interesting things.
Wait a minute. There's nobody at the games, but they're too loud? It's like the food is terrible and the portions are so small.
Well,
how can that be?
Well, he's referring to the sound system.
He's referring to that. Well, let's go to Mike DeMauro, and Mike joins us on the phone. He's from the Day of New London. And Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime. It's great to be with you.
Hey, so I got to ask, is this some part of a big trend that I think we've talked about on the program before that really points to an overall decline in the interest of the women's game? Are we spoiled, or does it really have to do with these 9 o'clock start times and just some bad scheduling on the part of ESPN?
I think the answer to that, John, is yes, yes, and yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little bit – it's got a little to do with all of it, although, you know, in years past, the NCAA would announce host sites for the first and second rounds, maybe back in the fall, which would give host schools, you know, 4 or 5 months to sell tickets to these games. This year, they decided they weren't going to announce them until the selection show, which was Monday the 16th. So UConn basically had 3 days to sell tickets for games that probably weren't going to be all that close.
Well, yeah.
in the first place. So I kind of don't blame the fans as much.
Yeah.
But, on this one.
But I think that it's, and Colin, this is one of the things that it gets to so many different issues. You know, we had Howard the caller talking about the fact that, you know, for the most part, we're talking about an older demographic of UConn fans, and that is undeniably true. We've seen a decline in attendance overall for women's basketball. Then we have the problem of not enough lead time, very, very late games. What does it all add up to you, Colin?
I think there's, I mean, first of all, I think I bow to what Mike has to say about this. I mean, he knows a lot more about it. But I have been watching UConn's women's basketball for a long time. And I will tell you that, I mean, the problem that's always been, let me just go back up and say, why does everybody love men's March Madness? Why is it such an incredibly popular thing, even among people who don't watch college basketball the rest of the year? And the answer is upsets, right? I mean, everybody likes this whole idea that Valparaiso is going to knock somebody off. You know, Stephen F. Austin. I mean, most of these upsets fail to happen. But they happen, it's like gambling. They happen just often enough so that you'll stay in it. And one of the problems with women's basketball is that so many of these games are so starkly non-competitive. I mean, not only is a 16 seed never going to knock off a 1, just the same as is the case in men's, but they lose 80-30, you know? And I mean, we've all been to these UConn women's games. I mean, my son and I used to go to Gamble, and we'd, like, leave in the middle of the game and run on the outdoor track for a while and then come back in. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's like watching a fly go up a drape. And either they're going to solve this problem or they're not. But if they don't make more of the games competitive, they're going to have a sport that's popular in 6 or 7 or 8 markets and pretty much not that interesting to the rest of the country. It's why Diana Taurasi, and I directed you, Mr. Dankowski, to this terrific article in the New York Times
last
week, is not only playing in Russia but sitting out a WNBA season because her Russian superiors prefer it that way, because she makes a lot of money in Russia and WNBA salaries are, by the standards of competitive professional sports, kind of a joke. So, you know, if this problem doesn't get solved, it's just not good for women's basketball.
Hey, Paz, do you have a thought?
No, I think Mike nailed it. It's you can't. You know, you've got to prepare for these things, particularly for the women's game, which, you know, struggles nationally. You know, the Times also had a story about the Duke game, you know, where, you have the Cameron crazies. Well, there were, I think, 1,500 of them at the game the other day. And by the way, it was a competitive game. But, you know, the place was dead.
Christine?
Yeah. As somebody whose niece actually just recently played at Amherst, so Division III women's basketball is much different. It's, the games are much closer, and, I feel like they're much more competitive than Division I women's basketball.
And really, but Mike, that's one of the issues that has been plaguing really UConn women's basketball all along, and Colin said it. It's them, it's a handful of other programs, maybe the Tennessees and the like, and then there's really nothing. How does this get fixed? Because we can't fix it necessarily at the local level. It's something that has to be fixed by the NCAA. And frankly, they do such a bang-up job of fixing everything else, I don't know if we should hold our breath. What do you say, Mike?
Well, I think I think that the schools themselves have to commit more to the women's programs. I think what you have in most places right now is sort of this feigned interest. Okay, we'll throw a little money over here, over at this, just to kind of make it look good. But I think they really need to try way harder and hire better coaches who can go find better players. I mean, I know it seems like UConn's got the only 12 good ones in the country, but that's not true. There's a lot of good players out there. I don't think they're being coached well, and I don't think they're being supported as well as their men's counterparts.
I want to get to George in Windsor quickly. Hi, George. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to comment that why the crowds are declining. When they won the first title in 1995, they generated an interest here in people that was wedded and then sated in the early 2000s. And all the people, if you watch the obituaries now, invariably, every obituary, people in their 80s or around that age, says that, comments that they were avid UConn women's basketball fans. That class of people that were so excited and couldn't wait to get into that place, I tried many times. And my daughter used to buy me tickets for Christmas or ahead of time so I could get in there when the place was packed 10,000 and more. And, you know, the people are dying off, and the people who are in that area, age range now that would be interested in it are sated and with the success. And the TV coverage, of course, now is constant. SNY goes on for 3.5 hours, which is not – I'm not complaining. I love it. And John Wooden once commented. He says, UConn women play the game the way it was supposed to be played. And that's the beauty of it, if you can appreciate it.
Thanks, George, so much.
The other demographic is young families. I mean, as the father of two girls, I mean, we used to go to a lot of UConn games. And the beauty of it is you would go to a 7 p.m. game and you could have the kids home and in bed by 9:15. Basketball's great that way. But my girls loved it. I mean, they grew up going to UConn games, and you know, particularly when they played in Hartford, it was it was a super night out.
And it's a big event, Christine.
Yeah, I just want to ask Mike if there was a greater parity 5 or 6 years ago.
No, Christine. No, I wouldn't say so. I'm not sure we've ever gotten good. It's ever gotten to the level of where. As Colin was saying, you could turn on a game and not know who was going to win.
I know. Nothing like those 75-22 scores. And Mike DeMore, assistant sports editor and columnist for the Day of New London. Thanks so much, Mike, for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Hey, we just have a couple minutes left. And staying with sports, Dick Blumenthal has been on a little bit of crusade over the course of the last couple of years. He's been touring around with John McCain, the Arizona senator, and they've been single-minded in their purpose. They want to change something very important that's going to impact an awful lot of Americans. It's not talking about overseas policy. It's not talking about some sort of budgetary issue. It's about changing the NFL blackout rule. And it seems as though Dick Blumenthal has finally won in this crusade, Paz. What did he do to change the minds of the NFL to essentially say, we don't have to black out the games if you don't sell them out?
I don't care. I really don't care.
You don't care?
I don't care.
Colin, the NFL is like the biggest thing happening in America. More people love the NFL than love just about anything else. Dick Blumenthal is trying to make it so that more people can see more games. Isn't that a good thing?
I suppose it is. I mean, one of the things that we've sort of been talking about a lot over the last year is that the NFL somehow or other is a nonprofit. So, I know. It's one of the true things that you can just sort of say and people will laugh hysterically.
Yeah. You know? There have only been two games, I think, that were black. Blacked out in the last like 10 years. It's like, come on, Dick, find something else to do.
Well, yeah. but I mean, it leads to sort of a bigger issue that he's been getting at, trying to make sure that fans who are paying good money for this, and also the fact that so many of us are just bankrolling these big sports stadiums ourselves. I mean, we're paying for a new stadium in Foxborough with our own tax dollars. We should be able to see a game whether or not we sell out the stadium,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, as usual, I mean, Dick Blumenthal, he's on our side, He's still an attorney general, even if he's a U.S. senator. He'll always be an attorney general. When he was born, the obstetrician said, Mrs. Blumenthal, I think it's an attorney general. But I think the larger question, I mean, I think we're having a larger and more interesting conversation about professional football right now. And to me, Chris Borland is a lot bigger story. Chris Borland, the very young San Francisco 49ers linebacker who quit after one season because he didn't want to wreck his brain, is a much more interesting story than Dick Blumenthal. It's really the first time in sports where you're starting to see the players ask such a fundamental question about what they're doing.
But whenever players ask that fundamental question, Colin, lawmakers always trail behind and then try to pull together the threads of this. I mean, do you see all of these things being some sort of a movement toward the U.S. government saying, you know what, we need to look into football. We need to look into the fact that the players aren't necessarily safe, that it, they don't do a very good job when it comes to how they treat women, and there's an awful lot of things that the fans pay for that they should get more for.
I think there's sort of growing sentiment, but as you began this conversation by saying it is the most popular thing in the world, pretty much.
In
you
the know, whole world.
It's very difficult. You're fighting a huge tide, which is that people just love NFL football in terms of, you know, just advertising dollars and television exposure. There's kind of nothing
it. I think Plymouth all succeeded because the NFL finally acknowledged it doesn't matter who shows up. It's a TV studio. That's right. What the stadiums are.
Mark Pazniokas is Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. Colin McEnroe is host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Christine Stewart is editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Thank you all for coming in for The Wheelhouse today, which is always produced by Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.